All right, like Danny said, I'm a developer here in the Philadelphia area, and if you ever want to get in contact with me, you can get a hold of me at my email address, DannyProjectSandbox.com, or on my blog, geeksofblogs.net/DaneMorgridge, or you can get me on Twitter, once again, at DaneMorgridge. I'm on Twitter pretty much all the time. It's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. I frequently on there helping people actually out with any grammar questions. So let's go ahead and just jump right in. And our agenda today for the first part of the session is we're going to look at a quick history of data access in .NET. We're going to look at what is the Unity framework, some tools that can be used around it. We'll talk about EF1 a little bit and then EF4. We'll go through using the Unity framework from a basic level and go into some demos, and that'll be it. So let's jump right into history of data access in .NET. Pretty much, I would say probably 95% of applications use data in some form, and a large portion of those would be a relational database. I mean, I imagine everybody's here. Who's working with databases here? Pretty much, yeah, I think it's just about everybody. Okay, so when .NET first came out, you had a couple options. The first one was ADO.NET Inline SQL. And this is actually the way I started doing .NET, because you're coming from the old ADO route. That was the easiest way to get in. Or you'd have to have your SQL files or SQL content, you know, directly inside your code. And then they came across with a thing called data sets. And data sets were pretty cool. They definitely had their time. I didn't use them a lot, but they were very nice if you needed to pull down a lot of data and do some data binding and things like that. And, of course, there's stored procedures, which I know are still widely used. And then this interesting thing comes on the scene called an ORM tool, or an object relational mapper. And what the object relational mapper tools do is they take your database, and they map it to objects that you're used to working with. Because as a developer, we tend to think a little bit differently than database guys do. You know, we want to work in objects. We want to work in the things that are going to make more sense to us as code, whereas the database guys are kind of on the other end. And so what an ORM tool does is it kind of brings the two together. So you as a developer can work in the data the way you want to, and the database can still be the way the database developer wants it to be. Some of the popular ones out there, there's probably close to 20 all total that have been in the .NET space, and there's not very many of them left. Outside of Microsoft, there's LBLGen. This is actually the first one that I worked with, and it's a good tool. There's some things I didn't like about it, but it works very well. There's Hibernate. This is probably one of the most popular. It's open source and is used by a lot of .NET developers. There's Entity Spaces, which is another one. This one's not open source, but it's also another good tool. And then there's Telerik Open Access ORM, which is one of the newer ones on the scene. You can get a lot of information if you go to Stephen Forte's blog. He blogs has a lot of good posts on it. So what is the Entity Framework? Well, first of all, the Entity Framework is an object relational mapping tool. And it is Microsoft's core data access strategy going forward. So you learned a little bit about linked to SQL earlier today. And linked to SQL was basically, it was formed to do, you know, sort of showcase link, because link on its own, you know, I mean, although it's cool, it was really hard to show developers, you know, hey, this is what we, you know, this is how powerful this is. So they ended up coming up with linked to SQL and that shift to Visual Studio 2008. But moving forward, it's pretty clear from Microsoft that Entity Framework is where the new innovation is going to happen. It manages any relationships through what's called the Entity Data Model. Now, the entity relationship concept has been around for quite a while. You know, an entity is basically just an entity. It is what it is. And so having the relationship between the two so everything works well together and you can flow, this concept has been around for a while, but never really captured inside an ORM tool the way that Microsoft has through their entity data model, which is really where everything, all the magic happens and is built around. Entity Framework, it tracks the state of entities and performs operations based on state changes. So we're going to talk a lot about the object context today, and that's what actually tracks the state. So if you change your class, it's an entity, the Entity Framework is going to actually know that you changed it. And it can be used with data binding, which is, how many people are doing data binding on a regular basis? Yeah, a few of you. I know it's great in, you know, regular ASP.NET web forms, be able to bind to a data grid. You know, you can crank out some cool applications very fast, and Entity Framework does support data binding. It also supports it in WPF, so it makes it very nice for doing your data there. And Entity Framework is also the backend for WCF data services. And I believe you can also use Link to SQL, but you know, as I said, the core data access strategy for Microsoft moving forward is native. But with 2008, you have Link to SQL, as you learned about earlier today. And then with 2008 Service Pack 1, we got Entity Framework 1. Now, Entity Framework 1 got a bad rap pretty quick. Has anybody heard of the Entity Framework vote of no confidence? Yeah, a couple of you. So basically what happened is a bunch of people got together, and it was about $800 or $900 all total, and basically listed out about 8 features that they didn't thought Entity Framework was missing. And honestly, I mean, it was. If you look at some of the other, like in Hibernate, some of the other ORM tools, there were features that were missing. And so the vote of no confidence was basically an open letter to Microsoft, to the product team, saying, we're not going to use Entity Framework, and this is why. And they listed out a whole bunch of issues. And, I'd say they were most of the part pretty valid. And the product team listened, and with Entity Framework 4, almost every single one of those issues has been addressed. Now, what's kind of interesting is most of the issues that they had within the framework were also issues with Link to SQL, but not sure why it didn't get the treatment. There's also this really cool tool called LinkPad. Anybody seen LinkPad?
The demo okay.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess I won't demo it then, except very briefly with the Entity Framework part that I want. LinkPad is an awesome tool, and there's a free version that you can pay for IntelliSense. And there's another tool that I bet you guys haven't seen today, and that is the Entity Framework Profiler. Has anybody heard of this? Yep. Entity Framework Profiler was a tool written by Andy Harim, who is very active in Hibernate, one of the main guys behind it. And he wrote a profiling tool that allows you to see everything that goes on behind the scenes. So you can see the SQL calls, but not only that, it shows you, like if you're at MVC, it actually shows you the URL that the data call came from. It shows you the classes. It shows you timing. It shows you the SQL. All kinds of really cool things. And if we have time, I'll show that off. All right, so let's jump right into Entity Framework 1. A little bit about EF1 itself. Like I said, you guys already heard a little bit about Link to SQL. But it was, of course, released with .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1. Now, it uses Link or Entity SQL for queries. This is one of the differences between the two, is with Link to SQL, you're stuck with pretty much Link, and you can't actually query any other way. Well, with Entity Framework, you also have this thing called Entity SQL, which is very much like T-SQL, like you do against the database, but it's actually... it's all string-based, just like T-SQL is, but it actually goes against the model and not the database directly, which I'll show you a little bit about that in a little bit or so. And it works with multiple data providers. You know, one of the things about Link to SQL is you're stuck with SQL Server, and that's pretty much it. With any framework, out of the box, you get support for SQL Server, SQL Server CE. There's also providers for MySQL. I know Oracle's coming out with one. Pretty much anybody who writes a provider, you can use it. Now, Microsoft has also left it up to the providers to create their own. So there's not as many as there probably could be, but I know I've personally used the MySQL one, and it works very well. The data model can also be different from the database schema. This is another difference that EF has with Link to SQL, in that you can craft additional entities in your model that map to partial pieces in your table. Now, you have to go through and set some restrictions. What you can do there, but if you've got a database that has, I'm sure you guys have seen this, where you've got a DBA who normalizes, to the seventh degree, which doesn't actually exist, but, could go out way beyond what would normally be necessary. And so you've got a lot of tables for things that aren't really necessary. Say you just want to work with address data, and the DBA's got a city table and a state table, and it just, 4 or 5 tables to really manage one real set of data. You can, in the Entity Framework, build a real entity that maps all that, so you work with one set of objects. And it works well with complex schemas, and updates to the model are easy. This is really a tooling issue when you pull up your EDMX file in Visual Studio. When you want to add, if you make a change to the database, you need to add something new, all you do is right-click on the model and hit Update, and it will go back to the database and it will update everything. You don't have to delete it and recreate it. There will be times where if you delete certain foreign keys or things like that, you might have to. But from a general standpoint, updating is very easy, and you can do it quickly. Okay, so moving on to EF4, we'll be released with .NET 4, which is coming out in just a few weeks. And the version was changed to sync with .NET. So a lot of people have asked me, well, why did they go from 1 to 4? And the official answer is that they're changing to sync up the version so that, you know, the version of Entity Framework matches the version of .NET that it actually comes with. And I've heard other things, like they're just trying to make it look more mature, but the official answer is that they're syncing it up with the versions of .NET. Okay, so what's new in Entity Framework 4?
Question.
Yes.
Do you expect, therefore, that you will follow the same release
cycle? I believe that's going to be the case. The question was if Entity Framework was going to follow the release cycle of Visual Studio, and I know there's going to be some out-of-band releases because I know there's some things that they wanted to get in 4 that aren't going to be in 4 that they're going to be releasing after the fact, but I think major versions are going to follow Visual Studio. So what's new is, first of all, this is really my favorite feature coming in EF4, is persistence ignorance. Now, there's a lot of things that that happened to make this came about to make this happen. Just like there's a lot of features in C# 3 that make link possible, and the link wouldn't be possible without those features. Kind of the same thing with persistence ignorance in Entity Framework 4. One of the big ones of those is the ability to do POCO. And POCO stands for plain old CLR object. And I'll show you in a little bit, when you look at the actual classes that get generated by the Entity Framework, they actually are inherited from an Entity Framework class. And when you do the POCO classes, they're actually not inherited from anything, so you can, it increases that stability and things like that. And then we have another thing called self-tracking entities, which builds onto the POCO. And this is great if you're building a service application. So say you've got Entity Framework's application that ties into a WCF service that maybe ties to Silverlight. So you've got the WCF service, it's the Silverlight request from the WCF service, and then it sends up an Entity Framework entity. You go in and you make changes to that, and you push that back down the service. Well, the Entity Framework doesn't know that those have changed. So using the self-tracking entities, there's actually properties on inside the POCO that you can use to set of a state saying, yes, I changed it, or no, it's new, or it needs to be deleted. It makes it a little bit easier for Entity Framework to do its job while minimizing database round trips. And you have direct access to T4 code generation. One of the easiest ways to get into the POCO is through T4. T4 was technically available in 2008, but it was a little more difficult to get at. And basically, whenever you create a new project in Visual Studio where there's any sort of code generation, the T4 code generation is what is happening. And there's a nice POCO template, which I'll show off in a little bit, that is all T4, and you can customize it as necessary. That actually will generate all that code. And then one of the big things that's coming in, or that's in EF4 that was not in EF1 is lazy loading. That was really the big feature that Link to SQL had that Entity Framework doesn't. We're going to talk about that in a little bit on why I don't think it's personally a big deal. I prefer not to use lazy loading, and I'll give you some reasons why. But it's there for those of you who want to do it. There's also model first development. Visual Studio 2008, when you were to create an Entity Framework application and you went to add your model, you had two options. You could start from an existing database or you could start from a blank model. Well, in 2008, the blank model would give you a blank model and that really couldn't do much with it. You could actually add entities to it, but you couldn't save it down to the database. But with Visual Studio 2010, there's now a tooling in there to allow you to actually use Visual Studio as a modeling tool for your database. Does anybody use modeling tools like RStudio or any of those big fancy modeling tools? Yeah, I've used those before, and I love Visual Studio 2010 for it. Now, it doesn't give you as many options as you would get, you know, from a larger modeling tool, but it definitely does the job. And then another big one is code-only development. Now, what code-only does is it actually takes the EDMX file completely out of the picture. So all your Entity Framework classes and all your mappings and everything are actually stored in an EDMX file. Well, with code only, you do completely everything through code, which has a few advantages. You lose the tooling support, so you have to do everything manually, but you get some other cool advantages. We're actually not going to touch that today at all, but I've got some blog posts. I'm working on it in the next coming months to showcase that a little more. Okay, so let's get into using the Entity Framework a little bit. Everything begins and ends with the object context. As you'll see in a few minutes when we start getting into code, the object context is really where everything happens with the Entity Framework. When you go to create new classes, anything you do concerning the database has to go through the context. The context wraps your reader objects, your connection objects, your command objects, everything is in the context. The context also implements iDisposable, so you can wrap it into using to make sure that everything gets cleaned up properly, and it's a method that I would recommend. It is also responsible for all aspects of actual data access and change tracking. So the entity framework by default, whenever you've got an entity that's attached to the context, you make changes to it, it's automatically going to know that you've made changes and what those changes are. Outside of the context, the entity framework is not going to have that knowledge. Okay, so a little bit about the object context itself. So we've got a small bit of code. We're actually going to look at this live code in just a few minutes. So this spot here, the first line here, is the actual context. It's the EF demo entities, which is part of the project that that I'll show in a few minutes. I call the context DB. You know, I'm not even sure where I picked this up, but you know, all of us, we read books and we see the first, you know, the first time it's used, and we tend to follow some of those conventions. And I've always called the context the DB. I've seen it as called just context before, but whenever you see DB in any of the demos today, that's the actual context. And so here we're doing a basic query out of the context. This is the basic link query. It's, you know, very similar to what I'm sure you saw in the link to SQL. Now, what's kind of interesting about entity framework is that when you run this code, you would think that the database, as soon as this line was executed, that the database would get called. And it's not actually the case. The database does not actually get hit until it tries to loop through and iterate through the people object. And the reason for that is because in this case, people comes back as an iQueryable. So whenever the iQueryable is queried, the entity framework will go out and refill the data. So the easiest way to get around this is to push the whole thing out to a list, and I'll show that in code in just a little bit. So let's do some code. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is I have a solution here that is just a console application and absolutely nothing else in it. Go to the program CS, you see it's completely blank. So to get started with the entity framework, we want to go add new item, and we want to grab the ADO.entity data model. It's easier to get to from the data side. Let's go ahead and just call this a little bit of contact data here. And you see here we have two options. We can generate from the database, or we can start with an empty model. If you're going to do model first, you'd want to start with the empty model. And like I said, in 2008, that's not going to really get you anything. So here we want to generate from an existing database. And we're going to be presented with this dialog here. It'll give you a drop-down. So we want the actual EF demo database. If your database is not listed in here, you can just hit new connection. And this is a very familiar dialog for creating a database connection. Now, if you'll notice, there's a couple things here you want to take a look at. If you notice, the connection string is not your standard ADO.NET connection string. Although that data is still there, only the highlighted part here is your actual ADO.NET connection string, which everyone's used to. the rest of it is actually, it's all entity framework specific. You see here that we have a contact model.csdl, ssdl, and msl, and there's also a provider. So what the CSDL, SSDL, and MSL are, those are actually files that get generated and embedded into the assembly. So they ultimately become real files. But the CSDL is the conceptual model, which is what you work in code. The SSDL is the physical database model, which is your actual real database schema. And then the MSL is the mapping layer that connects the two together. And we'll actually take a look at a little more detail in the second half of the actually what the file contains. Now at the bottom here, this text box says EF demo entities, and if you remember from the previous slide, that was the name of our context. So whatever you put in this box here is ultimately, it's going to be the name of the connection string key in your app config, but it's also going to be the context name. So you want to make sure that it makes, you know, it makes sense, and they ought to fill it in based off your database. Go ahead and hit next. So I'm going to hit my database. Now you'll see I have three options here. I can pull in tables, I can pull in views, or I can pull in stored procedures. This particular database, all it has is a couple of tables. Everything else in it is just system-based to support the diagrams. So let's go ahead and add both. Oh, actually, there's two options on that dialog, and I'll show them back to you when we go back into this in the second half. Of some other features that are available in EF4 that are not in EF1, but as far as pluralization and foreign key support. So here is the actual design surface for the EDMX file. Now you notice in our solution we now have contactmodel.edmx. If we open up the generated C# file, we can see that we have a context, which is the actual context that's created, and it's got some other information in here that you should never have to touch. But if we look at the entities real quick, so we look at, let's go down to person. You see that person is derived from entity object. So this class is very tied to the entity framework. And if you were to use this in a service, the entity framework would actually have to be part of the WCF service. Now, the consuming part it wouldn't need to be, but there's a lot more data that goes across the pipe, which I'll show you more in the second half. So this is all the code that gets generated. Notice there's one file. There's two tables, so it ultimately has about 500 lines of code. I've heard that the upper limit for tables in a single model is about 250. If you need to get more than that in one model, I know there's some third-party tools, but the recommended option is to break up your models. So if you have a database that has more than 250 tables, there's a really good chance that you're never going to need to work with all 250 of those at one time. So you can go through and break it down into logical sections so that you can actually have multiple models inside the same project.
Will that make updates much
higher? Not really. Because when you break it up, you're going to be working with logical groups. So when you have a database that large, it's pretty unlikely that every table is going to be completely dependent upon every other table in the database.
And you go to update against the database and say, no, I've got 650 tables because they weren't in this case.
Well, no, because when you update, here, I'll show you the update, what the update looks like. So we go in, we hit update. And you'll be presented with the same dialog again. Anything you didn't check the first time is still going to be in this list. So you could go then add further ones there. I mean, it's still going to be in the list. So yeah, it's still going to query your database schema, but it's still going to work the same.
So if you add a string of tables, finding them will be almost possible.
Well, I mean, if they're named logically, it shouldn't be that difficult. So. But ultimately, yes. I mean, if this list has 300 to 400 tables in it, you just have to go through and find them. So, all right. So now that we have our model, let's go ahead and do a little bit of querying. Just get some basic information in here. So we see we have our console app that hasn't changed. Let's go ahead and add the context. So like I said, the context is a starting point. Everything begins and ends with the context. I like to keep the operations within the context as minimal as possible. So I really create a new context for every major data operation that I do. And the reasons for that is I can actually go create the context as part of the class and use it, and it will work. What I personally run into, though, is I've had issues where I've queried data and then run another query down the line using the same context that had some of the same data. I was getting weird results, and so I always try to make sure that I use a new context for every real logical set of data operations that I'm going to do. So the first thing we want to do is actually go in for our database. Clean the database out so it starts fresh. It's the first thing we want to do is we want to get a person in there, because right now we don't have any data to work with. So all we do is just person P create a new person. Now one of the nice things is we have full IntelliSense. So I can go in and set first name is Dane. And let's go ahead and set the date of birth to date time now. Okay. Now, this creates a new object. So we've got something to work with, but it actually doesn't do anything with the database. It's actually technically at this point not part of the context. So the first thing we have to do is we have to add it to the context, and we have two options. There is an add object, which takes two parameters. It takes a string of the entity set name and also the entity. So if I were to do this one, I would have to do my first parameter would have to be people. because that's actual entity set name, or I can do people.addObject. There's actually a third way. There's an add two people. So there's multiple, there's three ways to really get in there. I usually go this route. And just pass in our object. Now all this does when we run this, it actually wouldn't add anything to the database. All it does is put it inside the context. To actually get this added to the database, call save changes. And if we run this now, okay, and we go back and look at our database. You see that I just added myself, and if you look at the date of birth, it's timestamped for right now. So that's all fine and dandy. We've got one person in there. Well, what if we need, obviously a person's not going to be complete without an address. So let's go ahead and call this Dane 2, just a little separation in the database. Now, if you were doing this in regular inline SQL, you would have to write a SQL statement that would do an insert, and then you'd have to select the identity or one of the other couple ways that you can actually get the newly created ID. You'd have to return that to your application. You'd have to do another insert into the address table containing that ID, which can really be a pain. So let's just create an address. Type today. And let's do it out. Now, sometimes I love ReSharper, and there's other times where I absolutely hate it. And I'm still not used to it. I've only been using it for about 3 or 4 months, and it still kind of trips me up sometimes. Okay, so I have another address here. Now, I technically have a couple of options here, but the best option is to really just go into the person, and I can do addresses.add. Pass the A in, and when we go ahead and run this, the entity framework is going to figure out, I actually have two entities, and they have to actually be inserted in the correct order to actually make it happen. So now we go over to our database, and we see we have our second person in there. We also add a select address. You see it also automatically created the address. So I had one real object call into the object context, and then I had one call to the database, and it did everything. So imagine, excuse me, yep, everything cut back up. No, it's fine. So I've got, what I've got here is we create the person, we create the address, we add the address to the person, not to the actual context, and then when we add the people to the context, it still works. Now, what's cool is if I went, as soon as I created the person and I added the person to the context, adding the address to the person after the fact wouldn't really matter. So as long as everything is in the context at the time you call save changes, everything will just work. Now, imagine if you've got to do something complex, where you're not just adding two tables, but say you've got a business application that you might have to insert into 12 or 13 tables. Can you just imagine having to go through and write that SQL code and then being able to do the insert very easily using Entity Framework? I would say that Entity Framework or an ORM tool in general generally saves me about 70% of my database development time. So it's definitely worth taking a look at. So now we've got people in the database. Let's go ahead and do a little bit of querying. And a lot of this is going to be very similar to what you saw with Link to SQL, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what it does when the save happens, the question, go ahead, do you have more? Okay.
How about if I, could I remove that one before?
Yes.
So if yeah, so my logic was, where my logic and decided, no, I don't want to add that one in at all, or something like that.
Yeah, basically, the question was, can you go in and add or remove, after you've added in? And basically, what happens when you call save changes, the any framework looks at the context, and it looks at all the objects that are in the context, and it looks at what state those objects are in at the time the save has happened. So then it'll go through at that point and then figure out for every object in there what needs to happen. So let's do a real quick query. Now, I'm going to do a lambda here versus a link query, because for smaller queries, we don't have to, especially if you're not trying to do joins or anything, then this lambda is really my preferred method of doing data access. Let's go ahead and do a for each around this. And let's drop out p dot first name. Okay, so if you remember from the slide, I had a very similar block of code here where we did the list of people and we went ahead and looped through that. Now, if I didn't have this two list on here, like I said, the database call actually wouldn't happen until the for each line here. But since we're pushing it out to a list, it actually does the database call here. Now the reason you want to always push these things out to the list is if I were to duplicate this line and loop over the people again, it would actually go to the database twice. So it can be a little bit unexpected behaviors, but you always want to make sure that you push it out to a list, or if you're getting a single entity, you know, make sure that you're not using that add queryable over and over again. So if we run through this, let's set a read line, so you can see the output. Go ahead and run through this. Now we have both people are coming out. So I'll show you a... now if we want to get to the addresses, it says just a simple, let's do a for each, R-A-M, addresses. And I can do the same thing here. Hustle, line, spread out the street. Now, if I were to run this code in EF4 or in EF1, you would still only see the people. But the second one, the address, goes ahead and loads in, and that's because of lazy loading. Because what's going to happen, we'll get into lazy loading in a little bit more detail in the second half, but if you go through and you look at the code, what's happening is in the second for each inside the people, the entity framework goes, oh, well, you're asking for addresses, but I haven't loaded the address data from the database yet. So let me go get it. And so actually what happens here is this block of code actually does three database calls. It does the first one to get the people, and then as it loops through each person, it also does a database call to load those addresses. So even though the first one, you know, obviously didn't return any results, it's still three database calls, which if you were doing this in, you know, building regular SQL or short procedure and you wanted all the data, you're probably going to do it all at one shot. So you have a couple options as far as preloading. And if we go ahead and turn, let me just turn lazy loading off real quick. It's actually just as easy, it's just as simple in EF4 as setting an option on the context. You can also set this at a global level, or you can do it per call. So if I run this now, you notice we actually don't get the address data. So there's a couple ways to get around that. My personal favorite method is to do an include. Now, what's going to go in here is if you look at your model, you see we're querying person data and we've got the navigation property as addresses. So whatever the navigation property is what you're going to put inside the include. If we go ahead and run this now, we have all the data. Now, this call only made one database call. And it did, you know, did some joins and it got back the data, but it pulled it all back at one shot versus doing multiple database calls. The other option, if you want to do what's called deferred loading, which is sort of like lazy loading when I want to, you could actually loop through here and say, okay, you know, oops. I could call p.addresses.load, and then when load is called, it will actually go through and go back to the database. So you've really got three options here for how to get that relational data. You can use lazy loading, and I wouldn't use that outside of anything but a real small application, you know, as we'll touch on a little bit more. But you can go through and you can do the load up front using the include and pull back all the data. But if you want to, you know, if you don't know that you're going to need the other pieces of the data, you can actually go through and call the dot load and load on demand as necessary, because you may have business logic that'll say, I need it for some and not for the others. So you can do the database calls when you want without having to actually going out and doing another specific database call to pull that data in. So it allows you to give you a little more control on what actually happens in the database. All right, let's just go ahead and turn this off. Okay, so we've looked at how to do, you know, how to add, how to do query. Now let's look at an update. So let's go ahead for each of these people. Let's set the date of birth to date time. Now let's go ahead and add and pull 30 years off of today. Now if we look at our database, we run this, you'll see if the date of birth is all 2010 of today. So if we go ahead and run this now, oh, I have to call save changes. Don't call save changes, it actually won't save. So now if I run this, and I go to the database, you'll see that the dates have dropped by 30 years. So what the context is doing is we are loading, when we do the query, we're loading the people into the context. We're using the entities, but if we make changes, because they're still attached to the context, any changes that we make to those entities, when we save, automatically update. And if you want to delete, it's just as easy as off of the context, there is a delete object, and it will pull it right out. Now, you have to do it in single entities. It's a little more difficult to do a batch update, which if you're going to do lots of batch updates, I would recommend using like NDSQL or stored procedures. Yes. Yes. Okay. So the question was, is save changes transactional? And the answer is yes. Anything inside that context is going to be completely wrapped in a transaction. So if you've got four or five tables you're adding and updating at the same time, anything fails, it's all going to roll back. Now you can also override that by using your own transaction, but by default, it's everything is wrapped in a transaction. So, all right, you guys have already seen LinkPad, so I'm going to skip that. I'm going to go right over to our Entity Framework Profiler tool. All right, so this is the actual Profiler tool. It's still in beta. I've actually got a pretty old build of it. I need to get the new one, but it shows you, we'll show you pretty much everything. So what I've got here is I have an MVC application that goes through and pulls from the same database, and we'll go ahead and run this. It just has a few data operations in it, so let's go ahead and go to contacts. All right, so you see here our data that we just added is in there. If we go ahead and hit edit, you'll see that you know, it pulls up the addresses. I'll go ahead and change this and hit save. See it change. Now if we go to the profiler, we've got a whole bunch of data in here now that we can look at. So first off, it'll show you how many contexts were created, how long they lived. It'll show you all the statements. You can go by context and look at each individual statement. And then when you go in and click on the actual SQL here, it'll give you the full data to show you what is actually getting sent to the database. So this is a very, very handy tool in figuring out what exactly is going on. And it's just, it's got a lot of good info. I don't know when this is actually going to get released or what the final price is going to be, but if you're doing a lot of Entity Framework work, it's definitely a handy tool to have. You know, because using SQL Profiler will work most of the time, but if you have a query that has the word password in it, SQL Profiler won't show it to you, and there's no way to get it to. So this is definitely a nice little tool. The other cool thing about it is it's so easy to implement. All you have to do is go in your global ASAX or wherever your application is launching from, if it's on a website. Just put in one line of code to initialize it. But if this app isn't running, it actually won't do anything. So it's pretty cool for getting to see some cool stuff there about what's actually going on in the covers. So, all right, so let's abbreviating the first section a little bit. So let's go back quickly over what we looked at. We talked about history, data access, and .NET. You know, what is Entity Framework, the tools that we can use, a little bit about EF1, EF4, and then we looked at it. Does anybody have any questions on this particular section before we jump into the next one?